We have some communities that have over 100 calls every year of bears that are in town, so that requires a lot of resources.
A remote Alaska community grapples with the aftermath of the first polar bear attack in 3 decades. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 20th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Dan Sullivan addresses the commercial fishing trade show in Kodiak.
You know, there is much we don't know about research with regard to salmon, particularly during the maritime part of their life cycle.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's 3 universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
It's been 2 months since a polar bear killed a woman and her 1-year-old son in the small Bering Sea village of Wales. Questions still linger about what caused the bear to attack on their short walk from the school to the clinic. But more important for Wales and its neighboring communities is the question of how to move on from this tragedy. As KMBA's Rhonda McBride found out, it's required a collective approach to healing and vast reserves of strength and kindness.
The name for Wales in the Inupiat language is Kingigan, which means high place. The village, which sits beside a mountain, also hugs the beach, and in the winter, it's hard to tell where the shore ends and the sea ice begins. Ice that makes it possible for bears to hunt for seals and other animals that provide the high-energy food they need to survive in the Arctic. Susan Nesda, the chief administrator for the Bering Strait School District, says it can be an unforgiving land.
Tough things happen, and life in general is a little more difficult.
And this winter, even more so. The last polar bear attack in Alaska was in Point Lay 30 years ago. So this is unfamiliar territory and hard to see the way forward, just as it was on the day of the attack when windstorms whipped up whiteout conditions and gave the bear a veil of invisibility to prowl about unnoticed until it struck. Nesda, who manages the school district from Unalakleet, a community more than 200 air miles away, heard about the attack over the phone as it happened. She was told that some staffers and other community members had risked their own lives trying to save Summer Myomic and her son, Clyde Onktawasruk.
So they were hitting the bear with shovels. And the bear can be seen on camera leaving that attack and chasing those people up onto the school porch stairs into the front entryway, and the principal managed to close the door.
Staffers shut the blinds so the children couldn't see, but that didn't stop them from experiencing the trauma.
Each person responds to a crisis differently. You're fine 1 minute, you're not the next.
In this constantly shifting emotional landscape, Nesda says her staff and their 30 students have to be allowed to heal on their own timetable, a process which requires tenderness and patience.
Some students are really struggling. They're just really, really struggling hard.
Parents are now asked to escort their children to and from school. There are extra safety patrols around the building, and initially a shortened school day with a focus on emotional well-being, followed by a gradual transition back to academics. But parents do have the option to keep their kids home depending on bear sightings or how they're feeling that day. The school now has a snow machine to give teachers rides, and a fence is going up under the shop, an area that gave the bear cover before it emerged from under the building.
We're gradually getting back to a little more normalized day.
It's taken a lot of hard work to get to this point. The Kingamute School in Wales doesn't usually have a full-time counselor. They rotate between the district's 15 communities. But since the attack, the district has made sure that Wales has always had one on hand, which meant other schools had fewer counselor visits, a sacrifice each willingly made. The community has also taken some practical steps to move beyond the bear. Volunteers are regularly on patrol to watch for the Nanut, the Inupiaq word for polar bears. Michael Oxarock, the whale's representative on the Alaska Nanut Co-Management Council, says the council is working with other organizations to bring back regular patrols. With a warming climate and less sea ice, Oxarock believes more human-bear encounters are inevitable.
With the sea ice receding as much as it has, bears aren't able to go and hunt as well as they used to 15 years ago.
Scientists say it's hard to know how much the sea ice was a factor in the attack. It was locked in place when the bear struck. But Oxarock says the water didn't begin to freeze until December.
It finally formed maybe 2 to 3 inches mid-January. That's very late for the area of wells.
The bears need the ice to hunt for their prey. But Dave Gustine, the polar bear manager for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage, says the ice is just one part of a mystery that was hard for investigators to probe.
We kind of had to tread lightly, and one thing we landed on, we made sure by deferring to the community and the family's needs and requests any chance we could.
After a community member shot and killed the bear, which was a male, investigators took samples from the skull. Tests didn't find any signs of avian flu, rabies, or other pathogens that could affect a bear's behavior. Recent results for tests on a tooth put the bear's age at about 17. 15 is considered old for a male. Gustine says this may answer questions about why the bear was in poor condition.
Were your meals frequent enough to either A, put on extra energy reserves, or B, have to dip into those reserves? And so this bear was in a place where there wasn't any fat on his body.
Gustine says the bear had less body fat than is typical for this time of the year, and its age could have contributed to a rapid decline in its ability to survive. But other than the bear's age and condition, Gustine says there's not enough information to know for sure what caused the attack. Studies show that polar bears in the Chukchi Sea area are overall in good health, and until now, polar bears have not really been a problem in Wales, which once had a patrol but lost its funding. Lindsay Manjapane, a biologist in Fish and Wildlife's polar bear program, says the money went elsewhere.
We have some communities that have over 100 calls every year of bears that are in town, so that requires a lot of resources, so that kind of took the majority of our funding. But we do have some great partners now that might potentially have some funding to help out with these other communities. And it's definitely a priority for us to try to make that happen.
But for now, the community takes comfort in seeing snow machine lights off in the distance as volunteers take turns on patrol, pulling together to do the best they can to emerge from a dark and difficult time. A GoFundMe page to help the family cover the costs of mourning their loss far exceeds the fundraising goal. There are pictures of Summer Myomic and her son, Clyde Onktawasrook III, who glowed with the full-face look of a well-loved child, as well as photos of Summer's 3-year-old daughter, who must now grow up without her mom. One of the fundraisers wrote that Summer was kind and loved by everyone, described as a mother who was incredibly proud of her 2 young babies. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, after a roof collapsed last month, Palmer residents will have a local library again soon.
Palmer's a small town and I'm around a lot. And I hear from people how important the library is to them.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Senator Dan Sullivan reiterated his support for the state's salmon fisheries during his presentation on the final day of Kodiak's annual commercial fishing trade show, Comfish, on Saturday. Sullivan slammed a Washington State Conservation Group's lawsuit seeking to close Southeast Alaska's king salmon troll fishery as, quote, outrageous. Sullivan also touted the Alaska Salmon Research Task Force Act as progress on understanding declining salmon populations in western Alaska.
It seeks to coordinate and fund federal research efforts on what is happening to our salmon. You know, there's much we don't know about research with regard to salmon, particularly during the maritime part of their life cycle.
The federal legislation was sponsored by Sullivan and federal Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski and funds research for Alaska's declining salmon populations in western Alaska. It was included in the $1.7 trillion omnibus spending bill signed into law late last year. Sullivan, a Republican, voted against the package, citing what he described at the time as a dysfunctional process. The task force is still in its early phases and is expected to have a final report out in its findings next year, according to NOAA. Sullivan also highlighted a broad range of what he described as legislative wins for Alaska's fishermen, including provisions in the Coast Guard Authorization Act passed last year with Sullivan's support, aimed at maritime safety. He also said Alaska's congressional delegation hoped to see funding for Alaska's fishing industry included in the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Farm Bill reauthorization this year, but he didn't say what Farm Bill funding for fishermen might look like. The Board of Fisheries has approved an action plan to help conserve the Nooshigak's king salmon runs. The kings have declined sharply in recent years, even as huge sockeye runs to the district have broken records. As KDLG's Izzy Ross reports from Anchorage, the policymakers reached an agreement to limit fishing time when larger sockeye runs return.
As the Nooshigak's king runs have declined, the district's commercial fleet has hauled in record-breaking sockeye harvests in recent years. That presents a challenge to managers who are tasked with allowing enough fishing opportunities for sockeye while still trying to let enough kings escape. The crux of the discussion around the action plan has focused on how much sockeye and money fishermen should give up in order to conserve kings. Craig Chythluk is a commercial and subsistence fisherman who grew up in Dillingham. Chythluk is happy with the decision. He says conservation is needed. In 2021, his family caught no kings.
We caught a bunch of chums and we caught a bunch of sockeye, but we didn't catch a king. And we went early and we fished hard. And what I am most excited about this plan is that it's going to give the department the flexibility to conserve.
The structure of the final action plan was created by the Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute's King Salmon Working Group. Essentially, it relies on two tools. The first is a set of triggers for when to open fishing. The second is an optimum escapement goal for sockeye, which would greatly increase the sockeye escapement in years when those runs are expected to be high. Both the triggers and the higher escapement goals are meant to decrease the commercial fishing pressure in the Nooshigak District. Those optimum escapement goals give managers extra flexibility to have more closures throughout the season. Tim Sands is the Nooshigak District Manager for Fish and Game.
Part of the concern from the board and user groups was once we start fishing, we just fish continuously and kill everything that comes afterwards. We're going to continue having the breaks that we've been having and probably add some breaks to the set net fishery that we haven't done in past years.
The Board of Fisheries also voted unanimously to approve an amended proposal from the King Salmon Working Group to change the long-standing King Salmon Management Plan, which is in place whether kings are in trouble or not. The original proposal would have allowed managers to cut down subsistence fishing in the Nooshigak District to 3 days a week, not just for kings, but for other species as well. Much of the testimony from Nooshigak area residents and the local advisory committee asked to keep subsistence fishing open 7 days a week, a request that was granted. Michelle Smith is originally from Nunapichuk and has lived in Dillingham for the past 30 years. She testified in favor of keeping subsistence fishing status quo.
Yupik people have been stewards of the fish for thousands of years. We need each of these 7 days to subsist, not just to nourish our bellies, but our culture and our traditions, and pass these on to our kids and grandkids. Just as you would expect to be able to go to the grocery store each day of the week to feed your families, we depend on being able to fish 7 days a week.
Sands, the Nooshigak manager, hopes that the action plan will also help another species. Chum salmon runs to the Nooshigak have also declined far below average.
I think we would be much better off if we can take whatever steps now proactively to avoid becoming a chum salmon stock of concern, so we don't have to impose an even more restrictive action plan in 3 years.
Sands said that sacrificing a little opportunity to fish for sockeye now may save the other species and provide more fishing later. In Anchorage, I'm Izzy Ross.
Anchorage voters will consider 15 ballot propositions during next month's municipal election. The highest profile one would use marijuana taxes to fund early education efforts in the city. Alaska Public Media's Wesley Early has more.
Trevor Storrs is president and CEO for the nonprofit Alaska Children's Trust, one of the main supporters of the initiative. One of the first things he wants to make clear is that this ballot initiative is different from the alcohol tax passed in 2020.
This is not a new tax. The marijuana tax already exists. It's at 5%. It's about $5 to $6 million.
The taxes currently go to the city's general fund, but the new proposition would specifically allocate existing marijuana taxes to childcare and early education initiatives. Storrs says Anchorage residents are struggling to find childcare in the city, sometimes leading to a loss in wages just to watch their kids.
Here in Alaska, it's about $165 million lost in revenue because we have people that aren't able to work, calling in because they don't have childcare, things of that nature.
He says a low supply of childcare facilities is making it expensive as well.
Anchorage residents are paying 14 to 17% of their annual income towards childcare. That is more than what you would put towards university in a year.
He says the federal recommendation is for people to spend no more than 7% of their annual income on childcare. Additionally, Storrs says that childcare workers are often paid less than what you'd make in a retail job, and he thinks the funding could help support those workers.
We need to make sure those people that are coming in, they're working with our most precious and important resource, which is our young minds, and making sure that they are equipped and well-trained on how do you support early childhood development.
The proposition would also establish a municipal board to monitor how that money is spent. Storrs hopes that some of the money could be used to match federal and state early childhood grants to further bolster the field. While there hasn't been a lot of organized opposition to Proposition 14, marijuana industry leaders have a few concerns. Ryan Tunseth is board president for the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. He says one industry concern has to do with how the marijuana taxes are moved. Under the proposition, the money that the city collects in taxes would be removed from the Anchorage tax cap. That's the total amount of money the city is allowed to tax property owners. Tunseth says removing that roughly $5 to $6 million from the tax cap would free up space for the city to tax property owners.
Our feeling was that this was kind of a clever way to actually increase the overall tax cap and be able to just tax Anchorage residents more.
Storrs says the proposition was amended to address some of those tax cap concerns. If voters approve it, the Anchorage tax cap would be lowered by $1 million in 2024. Tunseth says another growing concern for marijuana businesses is that there are still some issues they'd like to see fixed in the state tax structure. He says there have been recommendations to change the tax from being levied on the cultivation of marijuana to on the sale of marijuana. There are also concerns over the emergence of THC products that come from hemp. They can sometimes give the same effect as marijuana products, but aren't regulated in the same way. Not only are officials worried that these products can be sold without the same level of oversight as marijuana, but Tunseth says these products aren't taxed.
All of those sales would technically be happening outside of what is considered marijuana or the marijuana tax. And so, you know, the other feeling that industry had was very much that let's fix some of these issues first because we think that you could probably get a larger piece of the pie.
Tunseth says the AMIA supports funding early education efforts and isn't entirely opposed to the notion of using marijuana taxes to do it, but he says he would like to see changes in tax structure before it goes through. While not in direct opposition, he said the industry is, quote, lukewarm on the prospect. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Wesley Early.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Westmark Fairbanks Hotel and Conference Center, located in downtown Fairbanks, featuring hot breakfast, Wi-Fi, and a fitness center. Reservations at westmarkhotels.com.
Alaska Pacific University offers degree-seeking students the opportunity to receive donor-funded scholarships, grants, and other financial aid. Apply for admission to be automatically considered for most scholarships. Complete financial aid applications by priority deadlines to receive optimal consideration. Financial aid counselors are available to assist. Learn more at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
The Alaska State Board of Education approved a resolution last week that supports barring transgender female students from participating in girls' sports, this according to the Alaska Beacon. The resolution supported regulations that would prohibit students whose sex at birth wasn't female from participating in girls' sports. It also stated that regulations should offer a sports division for students who identify with either sex or gender. This resolution was not on the published agenda of the board, which met from March 14th to 16th in Juneau. Members of the board could not be reached for comment. The resolution seeks to divide sports into two divisions, one for students whose sex at birth was female and one for students of either sex or gender. The resolution comes on the heels of Governor Mike Dunleavy's recently proposed bill, which would require parents' written permission before school employees could acknowledge a student's name or pronoun change. Much of the language used in the drafted resolution revolved around what it referred to as fairness in girls' sports. The language in the resolution said it was intended to balance competitive fairness, inclusion, and safety for all who compete. For any change to occur, the state would first have to change its regulations. Currently, the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District is the only district in the state that limits transgender athletes from participating on teams that align with their identities. When a landslide blocked all road access to the community of Lowell Point, just south of Seward last spring, it also shut off the flow of customers for local businesses. Now the deadline is approaching for those businesses to apply for a loan from the Small Business Administration to help offset the economic effects of the landslide. The loans, called Economic Injury Disaster Loans, can be up to $2 million and can go to any small, non-farm businesses or nonprofits. There's a loan interest rate of about 2.9% for business and 1.9% for nonprofits. One business that's applying for the loan is Miller's Landing in Lowell Point, a campground, fishing charter business, and event space. In the spring of 2022, co-owner Chance Miller was gearing up for a big summer.
We had a very successful year in 2021, and so going into 2022, we wanted to be ready for it. We hired a different management team. We restructured. We made a lot of larger investments, and then we had the landslide happen.
Miller says the company lost between $500,000 and $600,000 as a result of the landslide. Even with the road partially reopened just before Memorial Day and fully reopened mid-June, many visitors were just too anxious to make the trip out. He says signage and the visible damage to the hillside didn't help.
People are nervous. You know, the story's still fresh in people's minds.
Miller's Landing started offering a free water taxi service to get people to and from Lowell Point while the road was closed. And while it kept their 40 employees busy, it didn't bring in any money. Eventually, Miller says the state paid the company about $100,000 for the service. Still, it was a tough summer. He described this past fall as the tightest season in more than 40 years of business.
It doesn't seem like much, but when you have a 90-day season, a 100-day season, and you lose 30 days of it, that's a big deal, you know, and it directly relates to our bottom line.
Miller says while he is applying for the SBA loan, he hopes he'll never actually have to spend the money. But he wants to be more safe than sorry if something devastating happens again. The application is due April 12th. According to the SBA, federal disaster loans are available in the Kenai Peninsula Borough, Kodiak Island Borough, Lake and Peninsula Borough, Matanuska-Susitna Borough, and the Municipality of Anchorage. You can visit disasterloanassistance.sba.gov to apply. Palmer residents will soon have access to books, computers, and other materials at a temporary library site. That's after the roof of the Palmer Public Library partially collapsed on February 15th, coming to rest on top of bookshelves in the children's section. Since then, the community has rallied around the goal to reopen in the temporary space. Alaska Public Media's Tim Rocky has the story.
Palmer Junior Middle School 7th grader Connor Blair is an avid reader. He says the library roof collapse has been an unwelcome disruption to his after-school routine.
Whenever I walk home from school, I always stop there because it's warm. I warm up. I might read a little bit. And then there's a lot of books there that I would check out.
Connor competes in Battle of the Books and enjoys reading fantasy novels. But since the roof came down over a month ago, he hasn't been able to check out the last book in the series he was reading called Tale of Magic. His dad, Scott, says it's drastically changed his reading habits.
He actually isn't reading as much because he's waiting for that book before he moves on to another series.
Connor says he's excited about the idea of a new library building. Once engineers determine the library building is safe, books can be removed and relocated to the temporary site on the north side of town. Rachel House is the president of the Friends of the Palmer Public Library. She says the library is at the heart of Palmer, both literally and figuratively.
Whenever I go out into the public, and you know, Palmer's a small town and I'm around a lot, and I hear from people how important the library is to them.
A benefit concert performed by the Matsu Orchestra on February 19th, planned prior to the roof collapse, was attended by nearly 200 people. House says that the library has received overwhelming support from readers who want to help.
I saw in that moment that like our community really loved our library and wanted to make things right, like right away.
House says Senator Lisa Murkowski and state legislators representing Palmer are also supporting the cause. She's also heard from over 100 community members asking to help.
It's going to be a really long journey, but we have so much support.
The city hired PND engineers to assess the building, and they are the only people who have been in the library since the roof collapsed. During a site assessment last month, PND recommended that posts be installed to safely hold the weight of the roof before books and materials are recovered. It will be about a month before the interim library building will open to the public. In Anchorage, I'm Tim Rocky.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Rhonda McBride, Wesley Early, and Tim Rocky in Anchorage, Kirsten Dobroth in Kodiak, Izzy Ross in Dillingham, and Riley Board in Kenai. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde. Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
And by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska.
This is statewide news on Alaska Public Media.